So we're looking at 100 sites altogether, divided almost equally between open and cave sites. We have a couple of sites, one in particular, that have very early dates for cave art, North American cave art, in the dark zone of caves. We make a distinction between artwork that actually is exposed to exterior light and artwork that's deep underground. And in Tennessee, some of the art is over a mile underground. The reason we make that distinction is it becomes a technical problem to go to these places where they're decorating it, and they have to provision themselves with light. It's not a place where people live. It's a place that they intentionally go, so it's almost an act of pilgrimage at the outset to go to these places. The earliest example of that we have is a cave that's actually not very far from Knoxville that was discovered 4 or 5 years ago, in fact, and dated 4 or 5 years ago to something over 6,000 years ago. That's quite early. It probably is the oldest cave art that we know of in North America. We also have the vast majority of the cave art in North America. Here, we now know it was a tradition. We now have 70 caves that have artwork here in Tennessee, North Alabama, North Georgia, Kentucky has a few, the Virginias, but concentrated in the Southeast. And that's far and away the largest scale evidence for this practice of going deep underground and decorating caves anywhere in North America.
With the caves, how many sites are we talking about?
The study that we published in Antiquity focuses on the state of Tennessee because that's where most of our work has been done and the most intensive work has been done. We're comparing between cave sites with artwork in them and open sites with artwork in them. And as it turns out, they tend to occur in the same places or geographically very close to each other. They're at different elevations and statistically different elevations so that the open art is up high and the cave art is down low.
Let's talk really generally about the art. Mm-hmm. Petroglyph, mm-hmm. mud glyph, and pictograph. What are the differences?
We emphasize three forms. There's actually four, and I'll mention the fourth one in passing, but it's very rare. A petroglyph is an image that is engraved, literally sculpted into rock. Takes a huge amount of work. It's not something that's done very easily. It's something that requires foresight and planning. It's not doodling because there's, as I said, a considerable amount of effort involved. You have to provision yourself with the materials. They're cutting these into limestone and sandstone. Sandstone is relatively soft. Limestone's not. We have reason to believe, because we found some examples of it, that they're using flint, chert, stone tools to do this, which is harder than the rock they're actually sculpting. So that, you know, it's an intentional, intensive act of creation. Pictographs are paintings. So a substance is produced, a paint, according to a recipe, and then that's applied to a wall. We've done some chemical analysis on some of these paints that we found out there, and we find the recipe is actually fairly consistent and fairly simple. Both of those occur both inside and outside of caves. Mud glyphs are a kind of a special form of artwork. They require the presence of naturally occurring mud. It can be mud banks in ancient streams, or it can be a mud coating on the inside of a cave that's produced by a natural geologic process called condensation corrosion, where the wall begins to break down and leaves behind a mud residue. Those only occur in caves. In both cases, in order to produce mud glyphs, the mud has to be plastic still. It can't dry. And almost always when mud dries, it exfoliates, it falls off. That means there may have actually been lots more of these out there than we can find. But into this plastic mud, they trace images, either with cutting tools. Sometimes we actually think they're using their fingers, and we've seen fingerprints even in some of them to suggest that that's true. So I said there's a fourth one. Yeah. In a couple of rare cases, there have been sculptures found in caves. One of them actually is in the McClung Museum right now. It's a statue of a human figure, an anthropomorphic figure, sculpted of a stalactite or stalagmite. It's what's called a speleothem. And then there's a couple of examples that we've seen, one up in Virginia and another one in Upper East Tennessee, where they seem to model clay into sculptures, human faces in particular. It's very hard, of course, to tell whether those are old or young, and so we're not sure in at least one case whether they're ancient or not. But they made a lot of different art forms as they decorated the landscapes that they were occupying.
How do you go about dating these?
So the most straightforward way, the preferred way if we can do it, is what's called direct dating, where you actually take a sample of the material and date it. The 6,000 plus date that we have is actually a direct date from a charcoal pictograph inside of a cave. and we were able to scrape a tiny little bit of the carbon from the wall. We hate to do that, but we did it because we weren't sure that this was actually prehistoric. We submitted it for radiocarbon dating to a laboratory that uses a technique called AMS dating. It's very precise and you can use very small quantities, and they were able to get enough carbon to make a date on it. What that tells us is not necessarily that the picture is 6,000 years old, but that the charcoal in the paint is. We did some tests on the rock around it to see if it was being contaminated. We don't think it was. There's always a chance somebody picked up an old burnt stick later in time and made it. That's not really likely, but it's always possible. So direct dates are really the best and most sure way. Lacking those, and we often do, we try to get material that we can radiocarbon date that's associated with it. In order to go into caves and make artwork, people had to carry light sources with them. We know that Native Americans in this part of the Southeast most often used river cane as their torch material. This is all the way up into the historic period. In a lot of these caves, we find literally piles of river cane, burnt river cane, lying around on the surface where the torches would burn down like cigarettes do and the ashes would fall off. We take some of that and date it. Now, we're not dating the pictures on the wall, but we are dating time periods when people were in there visiting the sites. What we try to do in those cases is take a lot of samples, get as many dates as we can to see if there's sort of multiple peaks in the distribution of the dates to suggest that people were there at multiple times, or were they, did they tend to be there during a certain time period? Most often it's the latter, that the caves were used in a short and single time period. And so we infer from that, that the glyphs on the walls, the pictures on the walls were coincident with those visitations. Some of these pictures are religious iconography. And we know that because we find the same pictures in other contexts outside of caves. So one very common element is a winged warrior, a human with wings. Lots of examples carved on shell gorgets, on shell drinking cups. Those gorgets and drinking cups come from burials, from sites, from temples and communal houses found on top of mounds, from sites outside of caves where we have dates. So we know that they are what's called the Mississippian period between 1200 and 1400 AD. And when we see that image inside a cave, at the outside limit, we can sort of propose that it dates to the same time period. So there's three sort of ways we go about it: direct dating, dating by association, and at the outside, stylistic dating. It's always it's a puzzle. You're putting together pieces and they don't fit necessarily together as well as you would like them to, but sure, we're left with what we're left with.
Well, you've talked about this winged human in all the sites. What is the iconography that shows up?
The most common elements altogether are geometric forms, lines and circles, circles with crosses in them. And we know, again, from looking at materials that come out of open air sites, from burial contexts in mounds and things like that, that the circle and the cross was actually a symbol, a holy symbol, a sacred symbol that epitomized prehistoric Native American perspectives on the universe. It was actually kind of a map. It defined a four-dimensional world, in fact, encased in a globe with an upper world, a lower world, and a world in the middle that humans occupied. The great majority of things are sort of geometric forms. Aside from that, in what we recognize as representational forms, probably the most common thing are human figures, what we call anthropomorphs, because they're not always humans as we recognize them. Sometimes they're humans changing into birds. Sometimes they're humans with very large hands and feet with extended fingers. There are components to them that are not entirely natural, in our sense natural, but that clearly were important to the artists who were drawing them. There are animals, both four-legged animals and winged animals and no-legged animals. Snakes are very common in caves. They don't tend to occur outside of caves very much at all. Birds are very common in caves. They don't tend to occur outside of caves very much at all. Quadrupeds, four-legged animals, occur in both contexts. Dogs, we see fairly commonly in caves. And then sort of fantastic animals, animals that are blends of snakes and birds and dogs. So what's clear is that these images are depicting a world where boundaries can be crossed. And in some senses, going underground is crossing a boundary. It's going from our world into the underworld. Mm-hmm. Going to the cliff tops where the paintings occur up high is also, in a sense, crossing a boundary, going from the world in which we live to the world above.
what you've just said then is you think they've sort of mapped this cosmology using these sites?
Yes, exactly. And there are some characteristics of the relationships among these sites that lead us to suspect that there's a relationship among them, that they compose a bigger picture. One is their location. The paintings outside of caves are always up very high, with a very few exceptions, and they're not in the same areas where the ones that are up high occur.
What is up high?
Above 1,500, 2,000 feet of elevation. And consequently, there's only two places you can really go to do that. One is the Great Smoky Mountains, but that's not where they go. There's reason to believe that the Great Smoky Mountains has very little rock art in it, in fact. Most of it on the other side, on the North Carolina side. Mm. Whether that's a factor of people not looking, it's not entirely clear. The second highest country that is amenable to this is the Cumberland Plateau. And that's where most of this stuff happens.
You said at the beginning of our interview that, especially with the cave sites, this is not where people were living. This was people making a pilgrimage to this site. Mm-hmm. And the open air spaces high up, they're the same?
They weren't living there either.
Okay.
So the Cumberland Plateau is kind of a special place in any case. Most of this artwork that we posit this compositional character for is relatively late prehistorically. It's not the 6,000-year-old stuff. It's actually what we call Mississippian period. It's, again, 12 to 1400 AD, a little bit earlier for some of it. These people, Mississippian people, were agriculturalists. They lived in very large fortified communities in the river bottoms because their primary crop was corn. They were very warlike. They were highly organized. They built mounds that allowed them to access the upper world, or their priests, in any case, to access the upper world. Mm-hmm. They were very religious, as are modern Native Americans today, and as were the historic Native Americans that Europeans encountered when they first arrived here. But those big communities are down in the valleys. That's not that far from the Cumberland Escarpment, because you look right down into there. But it's a hike to get up there.
Yeah.
We know that they are using the uplands for certain things, as game lands. There are certain wild resources. You know, certainly there are a full range of medicinal plants and herbs that are up on the plateau. And the great thing about the plateau from that point of view is that because it has such a steep escarpment, especially on the western side, it presents a wide range of ecological diversity in a very short distance. You climb 2,000 feet and you go from the Tennessee River Valley to upland oak, hickory, pine forests on the top. It's as if you took the Great Smoky Mountains and collapsed them down, took off the top, because it doesn't get the high boreal forests that are up there. They are coming to the uplands, but that's not where they're living, and that's not where they're concentrating their activities. They're down in the valleys below. So this notion of pilgrimage to the place, you know, might well be embedded in the procurement of other things, but people are making special trips to go to this special landscape that is decorated according to their view of the cosmos in order to use it in a way different than they do the landscape that they live in on a day-to-day basis. The caves tend to be occupied for a very short period of time, as far as we can tell, and there's no evidence that there were ever lots and lots of people. It's not everybody that goes there. It's not everybody who does this. Probably specialists within the community that are responsible for going to these places, for making these ceremonial visits, for obtaining these medicinal plants and herbs. So it's part of a broader ceremonial cycle that also occurs down in the villages where there are more public sectors.
Is that the reason that now so many more of these sites have been found? Because there are more people who are specializing in going and exploring these caves? Or
we have sort of allied ourselves with a number of avocational cavers who've been out on this landscape, you know, working in caves, exploring caves for a long time, didn't necessarily know what to look for. Didn't necessarily, even if they saw something, didn't necessarily have some place to go and say, what do you think of this?
Right.
So when we began to do this, it really began with Dr. Faulkner again in 1979 when he started working on Mudcliff Cave, which was the first cave art site in North America ever analyzed. It's not very far from here either. But when Dr. Faulkner started to do that, he began to make these connections with the caving community, and it's just sort of snowballed over time. The more we look, the more we find. You know, we throw these numbers around because it's relatively easy, but at present there are more than 9,000 caves recorded by the Tennessee Cave Survey, which is an organization that keeps a record of caves of a significant size in the state of Tennessee. But on our behalf, let's say, probably 1,000, maybe 1,200 of those have actually been visited, and we have right around 60 caves based on that activity. If you carry out the math, if there's 9,000, we can expect to have, you know, maybe between 400 and 500 altogether. It's an issue that nobody looked for a very long time. To me, this is always an interesting thing because people have been doing archaeology in Tennessee for over 200 years and never saw this.
Are there any of these caves or sites that are open to the public?
Surprisingly few. And the reason is that those that are on public property are highly protected. Those that are on federal property, there are a whole suite of federal laws to protect archaeological resources. And these are, you know, sort of very vulnerable and very important archaeological resources. And so we downplay their location a bit. Mm. The state of Tennessee over the last number of years has acquired a few of them. Perhaps the most important is actually managed by the Cumberland Trail State Park. But it's too difficult to get people to. And so right now we're sort of exploring the possibility of making a replica people can look at. The one that is open is a site called Dunbar Cave, which is in Dunbar Cave State Natural Area in Montgomery County, Clarksville, Tennessee. Been a state park for years and years, since the 1970s. It was widely known that it had a rich archaeological site in the front of it. When the state acquired it in the early 70s, the State Archaeology Office actually undertook sort of preliminary excavations to see what was there. And so they knew that there was an archaeological site. But the cave art in that site wasn't known. It's been a show cave for almost 100 years. It's been open to the public. There have been guided tours. It was the showplace of the South, and there was a dance hall in the mouth of it and, you know, frequent visitation. There's a large amount of historical graffiti, including drawings of Civil War soldiers and signatures from Civil War soldiers. It's a rich sort of historical and cultural site. No one ever saw the prehistoric art until some cavers, one of whom is actually a historian, visited it in, I think, 2005 or 2006, saw some things they thought were possibly prehistoric and called us, and we went. And in the end, we found 36 prehistoric drawings of these religious symbols of a reclining warrior who's got an animal's feet. I mean, people don't know what to look for.